I'm Jean Marie Laskus. I'm a journalist. I spent my career helping Americans understand the lives of other Americans. Coal miners, gun shop clerks, staffers in the White House mailroom. In my new podcast, Cement City, I tell the story of an entire town. A dying town that you have absolutely no reason to care about. But trust me, you will. Listen to and follow Cement City, an Odyssey original podcast in partnership with Cement City Productions. Available now for free on the Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.
There's general agreement that policing is not the only way and maybe not the best way to reduce gun violence in Chicago or anywhere. What you may have been hearing about more these days is community violence intervention. What is it? Well, we'll tell you. Does it work? The answer is a qualified yes. Hello, I'm political editor Craig Delamore, and this is At Issue. Community violence intervention is a type of program that aims to help young people better navigate the challenges that they face. Is it the one right way to do things? Not exactly, but it is a framework, a set of principles being used around the country. One version of the idea is called Choose to Change, and it is being used in conjunction with the Chicago Public Schools. And there are a number of organizations in Chicago that use that program or something like it. The renowned University of Chicago Crime Lab recently completed a study of Choose to Change, and this week, the officials there made a presentation of their results. This weekend, with the UC Crime Lab's permission, we're going to bring you highlights of that webinar. It was conducted by Kimberly Smith, the UC Crime Lab's Director of Programs. She first gave an overview of the problem. She showed a chart with comparisons of homicide rates in major cities around the world. Most other places had low or moderate numbers, but no surprise, the bar representing the United States towered far, far over all the other countries.
What we see is when we look more closely, almost all of the difference between the U.S. and other wealthy nations comes from this gun homicide rate. Unfortunately, this element of American exceptionalism shows up in other alarming ways. For example, guns are now the leading cause of death for children and teens in the U.S. So what do we know about gun violence that creates these disparities between us and our peers around the country? And I ask that question, what do we know about gun violence? Because the answer is really important for how we think about solutions. Because contrary to common belief that most gun violence is premeditated, what you might see on TV in a show like The Wire, most gun violence actually stems from arguments, arguments that escalate in the heat of the moment. And to illustrate this point, I'll share an anecdote. Several years ago, one of our colleagues was in the Cook County Juvenile Detention Center, and at the time, a staff member told them that he always tells the kids who are held there, you know, they're not bad people, they're just people who made bad decisions during enormously stressful and difficult situations. Or, as he put it, if I could give you back just 10 minutes of your lives, none of you would be here. And I share this anecdote because I think it gets at potential strategies and solutions to reduce gun violence. You know, how do we make those 10-minute windows more forgiving, difficult situations easier to navigate? And one way to achieve that is by ensuring that there are individuals or adults present to intervene when these 10-minute windows, these arguments, these altercations are happening. Folks who can de-escalate. That's kind of the rationale behind street outreach organizations and organizations that do violence interruption. It's kind of intervening in the moment. Another approach you can imagine is to equip individuals who are navigating these critical 10-minute windows with new tools. And that is really where behavioral science interventions, specifically cognitive behavioral interventions, come in. So these interventions, they help us as individuals evaluate our responses to stressful situations. Those responses can sometimes create additional problems when a gun is present. So what are alternate responses? Cognitive behavioral interventions, they also give us more tools to better understand the behaviors and motivations of others who we're interacting with. So at their core, they really provide us with a set of problem-solving skills, you know, enabling us to cope with challenging situations. And at the Crime Lab, we've evaluated several of these programs. And I'll talk about a few of them today.
What Kim Smith had were hard numbers from four programs that are currently active in Chicago. And yes, there are more than that, but there are four in this study.
The first is Becoming a Man, which was implemented by Youth Guidance in partnership with Chicago Public Schools. This program is designed for 7th to 10th grade boys and involves 60-minute group cognitive behavioral intervention sessions held once a week. The next program is Choose to Change, which is jointly delivered by Brightpoint and these advocate programs you'll hear from shortly. The program is designed for 13 to 18-year-old boys and girls who are beginning to disconnect from school and given that higher risk of involvement in gun violence as compared to BAM participants, for example. Choose to Change offers more intensive programming. So it's a 6-month program where youth receive 8 hours of mentoring per week and participate in up to 16 group therapy sessions over the course of that 6 months. We've also evaluated a program that was run by the Northern Illinois Project Safe Neighborhoods Task Force, and that was delivered to individuals being held in the Cook County Juvenile Temporary Detention Center. This initiative consisted of 4 90-minute sessions and was really designed to engage and support participants during their time in detention. And then finally, we'll talk about Ready Chicago, which was coordinated by Heartland Alliance and implemented by smaller community-based organizations in Chicago. And through that program, individuals were provided with nearly 2 years of intensive programming. And it was really hyper-focused on men at the greatest risk of being involved in a shooting, either as a victim or a perpetrator. It involved relentless outreach and engagement. And then after participants were engaged, offered 2 main forms of support, employment and job training, and cognitive behavioral programming. So as you can see, there are some key similarities across these programs. And I unfortunately don't have enough time to do them justice in terms of like the content and the richness of the services. But you can see that they all incorporate group-based cognitive behavioral interventions, allow participants to address how past experiences and environmental factors can manifest and influence behaviors. They also all include that common theme of the presence of an individual who can kind of understand and relate potentially to some of those experiences that the participants are going through. Of course, there are a lot of differences. A quick scan of this chart shows that the dosage, the number of hours per week per session, varies. We also see differences in the kind of focus population where Becoming a Man focuses on 7th to 10th grade boys who are regularly attending school. A program like Ready serves adult men who are oftentimes in their 20s and 30s. And even the backgrounds of the individuals delivering the cognitive behavioral interventions varies across these programs. So in Choose to Change, clinicians facilitate some of these group sessions. And in the Juvenile Temporary Detention Center, the sessions were facilitated by staff who did not necessarily have a clinical background.
Now that we know the players on this field, the UC Chicago Crime Lab's Kim Smith gave the scores.
What we see when we are evaluating these programs is that they really do show great promise in improving violence-related outcomes. So the evaluation of Becoming a Man found it reduced violent crime arrests by between 45 and 50%. Our evaluation of Choose to Change found that it reduced violent crime arrests by 48%. And excitingly, we released an update to our evaluation last week. We found that the impacts of Choose to Change persist up to 3 years after the program has ended. Our evaluation of the Cook County Juvenile Detention Center found that it reduced readmission by 20%. And our work to evaluate Ready Chicago found a 43% violent crime reduction. With Ready, we also were able to detect impacts on shootings and homicides, both victimizations and arrests. I will let our research panel talk about that, but also important to note that we did not see necessarily consistent impacts for a program like Ready. Different individuals had different outcomes. So while there is a lot of promise, there's also still a lot we don't know about how these interventions work for different populations. And that's the meat of what I'm hoping we can get into in our panel discussion.
This is Jean Marie Laskus with the podcast Cement City. So there's this election coming up, a big one, and one guy's been indicted. People are talking voter fraud. Democracy itself is on the line. Sound familiar? Well, this isn't that election. This one is in Denora, Pennsylvania, a dying town in the middle of nowhere, where I bought a house and stayed for 3 years. Listen to and follow Cement City, an Odyssey original podcast in partnership with Cement City Productions, available now for free on the Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.
So let's meet the panel. First up are Monica Bhatt and Noor Abdul Razak. Monica Bhatt is the Senior Research Director at the Crime Lab, and Noor Abdul Razak is Research Director at the Inclusive Economy Lab. Monica started things off.
We do have some inkling of the kinds of interventions that could be really helpful in the here and now at reducing violence involvement for young people. I think the reason that we do science is actually to be surprised. And one thing that surprises me is the magnitude of these effects. And I think Noor will talk a little bit about the sustainability of these effects. And Ready Chicago, this was a very intensive program. It was a 2-year program that combined cognitive behavioral intervention with workforce involvement. And we saw huge reductions in shooting and homicide arrests to the magnitude of 65% across the board, across all participants. And even bigger reductions of almost 80% for those participants who came through the community referral pathway. There were 3 referral pathways to go through the program. When we started, I don't think any of us really thought that shooting and homicide arrests would have different effects than shooting and homicide victimization would have different, you know, effects than other types of violent crime. We also, I don't think, could have anticipated the differences in who was benefiting most from the program and who the program seemed to work more variably from. And so I think the thing that's surprising is, you know, what I would call heterogeneity, or the fact that it seems to work really well for some people, less well or more variably for others. And we can start to really understand that so we can give better information to practitioners about what kinds of interventions to deploy to which individuals at which time. But they all have this common thread of, you know, having this metacognitive element to it where it's skill building. And I'm an educator at heart. I used to be a teacher. A lot of my work is in the education space. And so I think to me, it's really heartening that these kinds of skill building activities in the sort of interpersonal behavioral metacognitive space, the clinicians here can correct me on the right vocabulary to use, can be really helpful in making progress in the immediate term in a sustained way. And I don't know if Noor wants to talk a little bit about what those effects look like for Choose to Change, but to me, that's the most surprising thing is like 2-3 years later, how kind of sticky the effects are, because we just don't really see that in social science. I think it's exciting.
Yeah. No, thank you, Monica, for teeing that up. And thank you, Kim and the Crime Lab for having me. Before I jump in, I just wanted to say thank you to Brightpoint and Yap, who run the Choose to Change program, and to my co-author on the study, Kelly Halberg. We also had a large team of analysts and research managers who were absolutely critical to getting this work done, especially Chris Pinto, Brandon Dimash, and Heather Bland. So just wanted to extend my gratitude, as like this work would definitely not been possible without them and many more people. And we started this project in 2015. So it has been a long journey, and we are really thrilled to see this work being shared more widely. So to talk a little bit about what did we see and Choose to Change, and what I found, I think, both surprising and I think the most exciting about the results is that I'll just briefly describe what we see in terms of impact, and then I'll talk a little bit about the program model and why we think we saw that. And so just overall, what we saw was that C2C participants were less likely to be arrested for any crime 24 months after the program started. And that is actually, it's about a 31% reduction in the probability of having any arrest in those 2 years afterwards. We saw that effect actually persist. And so even 3 years after the program starts, so about 2.5 years after the program ended, we're still seeing the sustained impact in reducing the likelihood of being arrested by about 23%. What was incredibly important, though, is that when we broke down those arrests by the charges associated with those arrests, we found these very large reductions in violent offense arrests. And so during the course of programming, Choose to Change reduced the number of arrests by about 47-48%, which was the statistic that Kim mentioned earlier. And then again, we saw this persistent impact. So 2 years after the program started, C2C is still reducing the likelihood of being arrested for a violent offense by about 39%.
Finally, Jonathan Davis is an assistant professor at the University of Oregon who works with the Crime Lab.
I worked on the Cook County Juvenile Detention Youth Outreach Forums program that was implemented by the Northern Illinois Project Safe Neighborhoods Task Force. And this program's much lighter touch than these other interventions we've been hearing about today. It was a series of four 90-minute forums. So literally youth sitting in a circle while they were detained in the juvenile temporary detention center. Importantly, it was totally voluntary to come. They were able to stay back in their dormitory if they didn't feel like participating. But most of them were excited to have kind of an engaging up, an opportunity to do something different while they were there. So participation was pretty high. But they sat in these circles and had conversations with community members about how crime affects them. They had conversations with police officers and command staff from the police department. And they talked to former offenders about some of the non-legal consequences and legal consequences of crime. Now, I was hopeful when I got involved in this program that we would see crime reductions because of participation in this program, because it was based on some of these other interventions like BAM had been done before we saw this, and we were starting to see some exciting results about that. But I wasn't expecting to find as big of the results that we found. This was only 6 hours total if they went to all four forums. So compared to a 6-month intervention, I would expect smaller interventions to have much smaller effects. But this is a group of youth who can really benefit from interventions. And on the previous slide, we saw there was a 19% reduction in the number of new readmissions to the juvenile temporary detention center when we look at youth who were randomly assigned to be invited to these forums compared to the youth who weren't able to be invited to the forums in the control group. But we see similarly, very similar actual reductions in crime when we look in the year after the program, in the 12 months from when the program ran. And we find a 42% reduction in arrests for violent crime. We find a 30% reduction in arrests for property crime. And this was a 6-hour total intervention. So I was hopeful that we would see benefits because it had things like cognitive behavioral training and practice about conflict resolution and discussions of consequences and connections with resources in the community and possible adult mentors. So all of those things had been shown to work, but I was really blown away that we found such large effects given how low intensity the intervention was.
You're listening to WBBM News Radio's At Issue. I'm Craig Delamore, and we're hearing about programs that are helping to reduce youth violence in the Chicago neighborhoods where they're being used. This grew out of a study undertaken by the University of Chicago Crime Lab, and those folks are the ones who hosted this webinar. At this point, we meet the practitioners, the people who are delivering the services, working with at-risk young people. You'll next hear from David Williams, Chief Program Officer for Youth Advocate Programs, or YAP. Julie Neubler is Director of Mental Health and Wellness for Brightpoint, and Jadine Chow is Chief of Safety and Security for the Chicago Public Schools. Dave was up first.
Choose a Change is, and you know, it takes on elements of all of our programs. Our approach is a community-based wraparound approach where we provide services and supports in the community. And we were very fortunate to partner with Brightpoint and bring together this cognitive behavioral therapy component to enhance our work. So it only improved our level of engagement, our skill development for the young people that we serve. And Julie can kind of talk more about Brightpoint's role in developing the program.
Sure. Our intention, you know, in joining the partnership with Youth Advocate Program was really to play off of both organizations' strengths. One of the things that Brightpoint, then Children's Home and Aid, was known for was our behavioral health or mental health, community mental health services. And to highlight was that we were a strong organization alone, but partnering with Youth Advocate Program we were able to really enhance our services and really get the biggest bang for our buck. What we found is the sort of the secret sauce in the Choose to Change program is not just the CBI intervention or the, you know, the CBI work, but the and not just the advocates or the mentors doing the wraparound mentoring, but really it's the integration of the two services together. What Choose to Change, what sort of sets Choose to Change apart from other school-based or community-based violence prevention programming is that it's not one or the other, it's both. And they're both happening, they're happening simultaneously and interwoven together. So the advocates are participating in the CBI and group intervention right alongside the youth. They're learning the skills from the coaches or therapists right alongside the youth. We're able to, our coaches are able to go out into the community and support the advocates and support the youth and to implement those skills in real life situations through different social opportunities, different, you know, different field trips and kind of things like that, that we're really able to highlight when and how to implement skills.
And you're talking about skill building. I think it can be hard for folks to kind of picture what that looks like in practice or in the real world. So would you mind just walking us through an example of, you know, some of the skills you're equipping young people with during those group sessions?
Sure. Well, first, the CBI intervention is group-based and it lasts about 16 weeks. And so when a youth comes to their initial weeks of the CBI work, they start off every session with one specific skill, and that's called SOS. And that means slow down, orient, and self-check, really zeroing in on the need for our participants to stop, think, and choose a different path. And so what that highlights is a need or an opportunity, creating opportunity in stressful situations and really any sort of interpersonal conflict or something like that, where you can slow down and really, you know, stay grounded and stay in your thinking brain. What that skill highlights are, you know, mindfulness techniques, grounding techniques like deep breathing, visualization, and different things like that to really stay in your body. And over time, you know, with the help of the advocates going out into the community and practicing those skills when there's an opportunity or when, you know, when something like that might come up, or you know, we're really seeing youth embrace these things in really small ways sometimes, and just taking an extra second or you know, and sometimes a little longer. They do role plays out in the, you know, when they're talking through situations with their advocates that maybe is causing conflict or worry or stress, they slow down and and an advocate will help them problem solve about how they're going to communicate with their teacher, with their parent or with a peer about what's going on. And part of the group work is really being able to identify what's happening on the inside so that we can see how it's impacting the things on the outside and draw and making those connections. And there's a ton of, you know, specific activities that we do to sort of illustrate and support the skill growth and reflection that really is at the heart of the Choose to Change programming.
Jadine Chow from CPS says they adopted Choose to Change when they saw how well it was doing in different parts of the city.
Choose to Change is an extremely important program to Chicago Public Schools. Just ask any of our families or our principals who have touched the program. As Kim just stated, we saw the results early on and we said, this is something we want to explore. At the same time, we also know that scalability and implementation it can be tricky once you hit a certain level. And so one of the things that we talked about when University of Chicago and Yap and Brightpoint said, hey, we're interested in supporting you, CPS, how can we do this? They created this program guide with the idea in mind that we know that every community is different Every community has different needs and dynamics. So how can we do this in such a way that reflects the fidelity of the program while also respecting the needs of the individual community and cultural relevance? So they created this program guide, and very generously, because it was really in all arms wide open, they said, how can we work with other organizations? Jadine, let's pull in other organizations who already have close relationships with Chicago Public Schools. So we actually expanded the program beyond YAP and BrightPoint to a point where now we have 4 additional organizations around the city: New Life, Lifeline to Hope, Build Chicago, and Bright Star Community Outreach. And I'll just give you some numbers. When CPS really started first getting involved with promoting the program, we were under 100 students. With this most recent expansion that we're talking about, which is what we call Choose to Change Informed, we have served, at the end of last year, 5,600 students, collectively between YAP, BrightPoint, and the 4 organizations we named. That is a tremendous, we're really proud of that. And over and over and over, we hear from families that this program has made a difference, and that's why we support this program.
Julie Neubler from BrightPoint acknowledges nothing is one size fits all. The program has had to change and adapt to the settings.
Over the course of the years that Choose to Change has been in existence, we have sort of transformed our approach to be unique to every group, to every school that we're engaged in, every community in which we're embedded in. One, you could go to a week 4 group in Little Village and it will look really different than a week 4 group in the Inglewood community or the North Lawndale community. And sometimes you might go in and the group will have experienced a loss or a trauma, and they won't even be on a week. They will have stopped and are just focusing on processing what's happened and doing that work. And that, I think, is something that I imagine pretty challenging from a research perspective, is that it's always just a little bit different. But I think is something that has really helped us to be effective. We work to make sure that our clinicians reflect the populations in which they're working. We're delivering services, in 2 languages, sometimes. And that's just sort of how we approached it. I know Dave has also, might have some thoughts about that as well.
Yeah. How we approach the work again, how we approach the work at YAP is, we do zip code recruiting. So we recruit staff from the communities in which the young people live there. And I think that we recognize, we ask them, the 4 principal questions. What do you need? How can we help? How can we work together as equal partners? And then at the end, how can you give back? And when you ask those questions, you really elicit, and they give you direction as to what direction the work should go, how we can provide support to them and their families.
So what is the future of Choose to Change? Professor Jonathan Davis says it's important that it has a future.
Monica mentioned this earlier, that we've seen a lot of evidence, or proof points, that interventions can have big impacts on outcomes that are really socially important, but there's still a lot of puzzles to understand about targeting and who benefits most from these programs and what happens when we increase the scale of these programs. So kind of building on what do I see the future of these interventions being is continuing to build evidence and expand our understanding about different types of programs and who benefits most from these programs, but also just using this evidence to convince policymakers to invest more in these programs so that we can see what they look like at big scale. Because even though we are seeing these large reductions, clearly the figure that Kim started the talk with, showing America's unique homicide problem, isn't solved yet. So it's exciting that we're making progress, but we need to use this evidence to expand the scale of it so we can make even more progress.
I would like to thank the University of Chicago Crime Lab and all the participants for their work and for the material for this broadcast. To our listeners, if you'd like a copy of this program or just to hear it again, please visit our website, WBBMNewsRadio.com. There's a link on the homepage, and you can also find our podcasts on Odyssey.com. We'll be back next week with another edition of At Issue, and I hope you'll be listening. Until then, I'm Craig Dullimore, News Radio 105.9 WBBM.
I'm Jean Marie Laskus. I'm a journalist. I spent my career helping Americans understand the lives of other Americans. Coal miners, gun shop clerks, staffers in the White House mailroom. In my new podcast, Cement City, I tell the story of an entire town. A dying town that you have absolutely no reason to care about. But trust me, you will. Listen to and follow Cement City, an Odyssey original podcast in partnership with Cement City Productions. Available now for free on the Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.